The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.
Hello, this is Kieran Hancock. Welcome to Inside Business. This week, I'll be looking at the fall in sales of electric vehicles and a welcome drop in Irish inflation, which might help persuade the European Central Bank to begin cutting interest rates from June. Umber Kennedy, economics correspondent of the Irish Times, joins me for that segment later. First, to electric vehicles. Figures from the Society of the Irish Motor Industry this week showed that electric car sales are in reverse, falling by 14% year on year in March. This compared with double-digit increases in the sales of petrol and hybrid cars. Even diesel sales rose by 9%. Meanwhile, a survey by AA Ireland found that half of the 1,000 respondents would not opt to buy an electric car. So why the hesitance to go electric? And what can be done to incentivise people to buy EVs? Irish Times motoring editor Michael McAleer joined me in studio, and I began by asking him to explain why EV sales here are going in the wrong direction.
Well, basically, we've moved away from the early adopters. So they've adopted the EV model and they've bought their electric cars, and they were an easy win for the new technology. What we're now entering into the more conservative mainstream market, and they're more into the detail of how does this compare directly to my petrol or diesel car. And for many of these people, the car isn't necessarily the most important factor in their lives. It is an A to B method of transport. It has to be comfortable, but they want ease of use is one of the big things for them, and cost. And they're very logical thinkers. While, you know, in every technology, the early adopters know that they're getting basically beta sometimes tested technology. It's not as well developed and it's not as well grounded just yet, but they want to be the first on the block or the first in the street to have that technology. When you get into,
they're the suckers.
Exactly. But they're willing suckers. They know what they're getting into. While we're entering the mainstream market, and they're a lot more concerned, and it's been surprising to see where their concerns lie. And then added into all that, there's quite a little bit of misinformation. There's obvious apprehension, and maybe it's been relatively poor education system and information system in terms of advising people why they should, what's on offer. And in many ways, we try and fill that gap and that void, but people still have some questions and reservations. And when they hear about various things like new technology coming on the block, and they expect new technology to come on the block, or they hear about concerns of the first early adopters and see the experiences that they had, they then are reticent to make the jump. And people, you know, in the middle of a cost of living crisis with housing and various other issues going on in their lives, the change of car may not be a priority, and they're simply not prepared to put up with the sort of frustrations and changes that would come with moving from their traditional mainstream internal combustion engine to a fully electric car.
Now, in parallel with these figures coming out from CIMI, we also had a survey from AA Ireland. They surveyed 1,000 people for their views on electric vehicles. And one of the things that struck me, you mentioned this in your piece, referenced it in your piece in the Irish Times, your explainer on this. Half the respondents to that AA Ireland survey, they don't agree that EVs are better for the environment.
There's always a concern about that in terms of the carbon footprint of the vehicle from the time of its creation all the way through to the end of life. And the argument there is there's a lot of rare and precious metals in the battery packs. And the battery is the biggest thing on an EV.
You've got to mine lithium, for example.
It's lithium. And with there are two types. I mean, it's something that's worth considering as well, that like everything in life, it's a little bit more complex. A battery isn't a battery. There's different types of batteries. So some of them are called NMCs, and they have nickel in them, manganese, cobalt. These are all rare metals, and they're harder to get. And there are questions, political questions, as well as ethical questions about how we're mining this resource. So, you know, an EV does require turning sod and turning up, just like a combustion engine requires the steel and requires the drilling for oil. An EV requires the mining for rare metal materials. So it's not as clean cut as some people may like to perceive it. But the end product, some of the arguments are saying that it isn't as low carbon when you do a direct comparison in the showroom, but over the life cycle of a vehicle, the evidence shows that it is, an electric vehicle is cleaner than
the emissions
normal.
Are much lower. Yeah,
yeah, but it's over the life cycle of that vehicle. And it also means that unlike the other cars, there's a lot more recyclable materials. And that's an industry, a sub-industry that will be created as more EVs come to market. And those rare metals can be recycled. But again, just it's worth noting that as we rapidly increase the volume of EVs in the marketplace, we can't create them from the limited number of vehicles on the road. You can't recycle 10 cars and get 20 cars out of it. There's going to have to be a lot more mining. There's going to have to be a lot more nickel, copper. You know, copper production, we're talking into microphones here, all the wiring here is copper. There's a lot more copper that's going to have to be mined to sustain this new economy and this new...
But we were sold the vision of electric vehicles as being a key measure to combat climate change and to reduce our emissions. It should be really worrying, I would have thought, for the government that half of the respondents to this AA Ireland survey actually don't believe it's of any benefit to the environment at all. I mean, that's not a very good starting point.
No, it isn't. And it comes down to this level of the information flow that the government have been issuing. There hasn't necessarily been a great communication strategy put together in terms of bringing people along with it. The first approach, it seems to be photocalls, and then the next would have been tax rebates and grants. Now, people do buy into the grants, and I think it's interesting that, you know, at the end of the day, I think the AA survey was showing there that when it came to it, only 11% of people were concerned about the running costs of EVs. The majority of them are concerned about the practicalities, battery life, and how much it's going to cost me to replace this later on. And that's down to how long the life cycle of the vehicle is, the massive investment involved in it, and then, you know, how inconvenient is this vehicle going to be in my daily life? Those are the key things that the people are concerned about. In terms of the environmental message and that message, I think the government needs to change tack.
Okay, let's just go through some numbers. When did EVs come onto the Irish market, roughly?
Roughly, the first one would have been Leafs around the early 2000s. So,
okay, so we're talking over 20 years at this stage.
Roughly speaking, yeah. I mean, these were really the IMEV Mitsubishi, I think, was 2000, or just around the time coming up to the recession and the financial crash. At that stage, we were stepping into an EV future, and Ireland was going to be a fantastic testbed, giving our size, and the range of these vehicles were really low. But there was a great promise of a future, and Ireland could have, and Ireland was being pitched at the time as being an ideal testbed because if its scale, its size, if we put in the charging infrastructure, we would have been an ideal.
All right, didn't quite work out that way.
At that stage, it would have required substantial investment. The investment wasn't made because of the crash.
Roughly, again, how many EVs on the road, on Irish roads at the moment?
Right now, well, the fleet is 2.3 million private vehicles. And
is that just cars now or trucks?
No,
well,
that's private cars.
Private cars.
So the entire fleet and the Irish fleet is 3 million. And roughly 3.7% of them are EVs.
So that equates 3.7% of 3 million, rough back in the envelope calculation, 111,000 vehicles. That was at the end of 22. We probably added some more then. Maybe we're in the 125,000, 30,000 range.
A few of those would have dropped off given the battery range of the initial models, and the early Leafs weren't doing great. So some of them would be washed out of the marketplace now. But the government's target for 2030, and the figures keep changing because everybody gets a little woolly in terms of what the exact figure they're looking for. The latest figure that was quoted in the Climate Action Plan, I think 2023, was for around 845,000 private cars to be electric by 2030. But the figure they consistently repeat is that 30% of the fleet should be EV by 2030.
So that's nearly a million vehicles, isn't it?
It doesn't seem realistic. When you talk about a new car market, and okay, there's trucks and vans as well included, but if you take a new car market of ambitiously hitting 150,000 a year, and it doesn't always get close to that. Last year was
100,000. So every vehicle essentially between 2030
would have to be electric. Would be post 2025, every vehicle would have to be electric. And not all the car companies are signed up to that level of EV conversion. Now, they all are moving towards that, and that's ultimately the point about this, is that setting these targets are all fine and well, but the targets are going to be set by the industry with big global political markets like the EU, and they're sitting down saying we're looking at a 2035. But the EU and the car makers are largely working together in setting these targets, because one can't do it without the other. And there's a lot of jobs at stake across big countries in Europe.
Germany,
you make that conversion as well. So now, the Irish targets are relatively immaterial on these ones, because we'll have to dance to the tune of what the suppliers will give us. If we decide we're all going to drive EVs or any other technology, and the cars companies aren't going to provide them. They're not going to build a specific factory or change the production patterns because of a market of 150,000 cars, which is something equivalent to the size of Greater Manchester.
So we mentioned 111,000 EVs. I mean, there are hybrids in the market as well, right?
Yeah.
How many, again, roughly?
Oh, that's a more substantial proportion of the market. So at the moment in the current sales, it breaks down in various categories, but you'd be looking at 20 to 30% of new car sales would be hybrids of some description. So there's regular hybrids and there's plug-in hybrids as well. So there's two types of hybrids there. And the regular hybrids are the majority of the hybrid market, but there's a growing sense, or there's a growing trend towards plug-in hybrids as that bridge. So it gives people the experience of plugging a battery in. The difference is they have a slightly bigger battery plug-in, and you can plug them in. You charge the battery from your wall socket or your charging cable. Gives you a flavour of what it's like. And then when that battery runs out, it becomes a regular hybrid, and it leans on invariably a petrol engine, a bit like the original Priuses that people would know as well. So it falls back in that sort of category. But for the first while, and the ranges differ, it'll run on pure electric. So you can get some of the Mercedes plug-in hybrids now are running over 100 kilometres on electric only. So you can, that's a lot of mileage for your average family.
Certainly for city driving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. Although they might be buying a Mercedes, mind you.
No.
But anyway, is there any analysis of what the experience is in terms of people actually plugging in a hybrid to charge it up as opposed to just filling it up with petrol, maybe, you know, plugging it in once a week, once a month, whatever?
Well, that's specifically with plug-in hybrids, and the initial I haven't seen any significant research on this, but the anecdotal evidence does suggest that a large proportion of people, when the grants were quite significant, were buying the vehicles and not plugging them in. And certainly the feedback dealers were giving when they were getting trade-ins of these plug-in hybrids was that the batteries were largely unused from the day the person bought the vehicle. It's really down to the individual choice. It would seem silly if you've bought that vehicle and if you're getting night rate electricity prices that you're not taking advantage of that, dependent on the fuel prices that you're using as well. And it depends on what people need to get around in their head as well. A lot of people are used to miles per gallon and figures, and they got used to what a good one and a bad one was. Then we converted to kilometres, litres per 100 kilometres. And now we get into this kilowatt hours per 100 kilometres. So people need to start looking at those figures.
They were always a work of fiction anyway, weren't they?
Yeah, but it gives you a grade. So if you're looking at it, now ignoring the official figures, what you're looking at, most of the modern cars will show you what your consumption figures are like. So ideally, you should be looking around 17 to 18 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometre as being a good figure and a good economic figure. Anything above 20 is a little thirsty, and over 25, you're probably going to have issues in terms of long-term range. And those figures, the nice thing about those figures is that they translate to their EV figures.
Okay.
So that's what EV owners need to get their head around.
Yeah. So what is the typical range of an EV now?
That's a very broad question. So the typical range would be around 400, I suspect, but it depends again on the battery sizes. So most car companies will offer different size batteries. So they will be like, they'll offer a 60 kilowatt battery and an 80 kilowatt battery for longer range. The longer range promises 600, and it depends as well. So there's, as I said at the start there, there's these lithium phosphate batteries, which are cheaper. They don't have as much range. But they seem to have a longer life cycle, while there's the nickel manganese cobalt, the NMC batteries, which can be charged quick. They're a longer range. So they'd be the ones, the NMC batteries would have, can offer, some of the car companies would say 600 kilometres or more.
Now, let's say you're going to Cork from Dublin, but it might take you, it's a Friday evening, and it might take you an hour to get out of Dublin.
Yeah.
So does that affect your range, the idling and traffic and stop start?
Shouldn't.
And
all I mean, everything that uses electricity, from your air conditioner, and these all affect, these affect your fuel economy in your regular car as well at the moment. It's just people don't pay much attention to that. But if you're sitting there with your radio going and the air conditioning on or the heat on in the car, that is using up fuel if the engine is running. So that's why a lot of cars put up auto start stop and had a smaller battery, had a supporting battery with them. So EVs are using energy if you're sitting there doing that. But if you turn off the aircon, if you're sitting there with no radio on, and the window,
sounds like great fun.
You can, yeah, exactly. It depends on the aerodynamics of the vehicle. So there are ways to negate that. But as someone who's who's driven electric cars to the west of Ireland, who's driven electric cars down to Cork, the issue is less about the economy, and it's always comes back to where can I charge up if I need to, and the amount of planning that goes into those journeys. And once you get into the routine of it, but if it's your first trip to Cork, you'll want to know where you can charge along the way and whether those charge points are reliable and how much you're going to get.
So what's the charging network like now in your experience?
In my experience, it's really patchy. Depending on where you are, the East Coast is pretty well, the West Coast is less so. And the issue is not only just whether there are charging points, the issue, of course, is are there enough charging points and what time of day you get there.
Yeah.
And it's not like there's a queue at the petrol, at the filling pump where that person's going to be 5 minutes, then 5 minutes, then 5 minutes. When you're beaten to the cable, and as I have been before, you know when you pull up second behind that vehicle, that's a half an hour or 40 minutes before you even get to charge. And then you wait, they leave. You charge up. So an hour on an extra journey. You'd find yourself drinking a lot more petrol station coffee than you ever thought you would.
Yeah, no, sounds like great fun as well. And let's talk about depreciation, because that's definitely one of the anxieties that people have now about EVs. What kind of depreciation typically is applying to an EV?
It's wild at the moment, and it depends on the models. But they are being hit.
Give us some examples.
Well, we had a story there recently where after 2 years, a brand new ID4 dropped well over half its price, and it was auctioned out in Merlin Auctions, and they had no bidders come for it at the end, and I think it finally went for just well below half its price. Leafs are effectively some of the early generation Leafs, because the range wasn't great at the start, so say 200, 250 kilometres at a real push. Now they're down to 100 or so. Some dealers and some buyers would say they're disposable products, they're white goods. You buy them and you use them when you're very close to home to run, do the school run. And they're great in that regard. If you can get them for next to nothing, use them for the school run, use them for the shopping trip, knowing you're only going 30 kilometres back and forward and you're going to go home and stick in a plug. Off-street parking is key, but that's those. But the others, and there's a scare factor. So because people have these concerns about battery life cycles and lifespans, that means that people are concerned about buying a two-year-old car, because they're wondering how long will the battery last and what impact is that. And one of the big gaps that needs to be filled, and is being filled in fairness by the new technology, is when you go to buy a used car, what state is the battery at? There's now technology coming on stream for dealers and other traders to be able to test a battery and give you a certificate saying this is what's left of the battery.
So like that's your iPhone, be vital. You can say there's 70% left on that, or 60% or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it'll tell you how many cells are working, and on a full charge what you're going to get, what capacity is in that battery now, because there's usable range and some of the cells won't work. But you know, there's also then been the talk about how much it costs to replace these batteries. And it's worth noting that in the more modern batteries, the battery is made up of multiple modules, and modules can be replaced as opposed to the entire battery. And then it also comes down to there are massive cost savings, and this impacts on the depreciation as well. So there's massive savings in terms of lithium. So the price of lithium was hitting lithium for the batteries, say per kilowatt, was hitting a 9,200 euros per kilowatt for a battery pack, we'll say. That's dropping, and the estimates are that the Chinese in particular can bring that price down to about 40 to 50 euros per kilowatt. If you take the average battery, then it's 65, 70 kilowatts. You're talking about, you know, $3,000 for a battery, an entire battery, as opposed to what some are experiencing when the lithium prices are high, and that you know, some people have, that was talking in the letters page of the Irish Times, of people being quoted 19,000 euros to replace an entire battery pack, which is ridiculous. But again, these were early iterations of the cars. They weren't, battery management systems weren't in place. Modern EVs are much more advanced in terms of managing the battery and looking after the battery than the first generations ever were. And this is the same with every, you know, new product that comes in the market. It improves whenever the biggest hurdles that the product faces, it gets better as it goes along.
What's the bestseller EV on the market at the minute?
Right now, good question. I think at the latest one, it was the Hyundai Kona.
Okay. So EV. What kind of price would that go for?
That's 30-ish. 30,000. Okay. Yeah.
So when you bought a new petrol or diesel car, the old rule of thumb was as soon as you drove it off the forecourt, it declined in value, maybe, I don't know, 10%, yeah. 2-3 grand, wiped off straight away. What's the experience with EVs?
Well, you're looking at what it said there, it was within the first 2 years, you've lost 50%.
50%?
Yeah. Now, that's at the moment. And again, that depends on the model. These are average prices. The most frightening thing is that because people are stepping back and are reticent about going into the mainstream market is reticent about adopting EVs, that has then, you know, and there's a certain level of misinformation going around, that has then made people reticent to purchase used EVs, which means that dealers who have used EVs are not going to be taking too many others. So we've heard quite a lot of dealers talk about dealers refusing to take trade-ins of EVs, which then further feeds when a neighbour tells you, I had an EV and the dealer I bought it, when I went to trade in, the dealer wouldn't take my EV.
Well,
that scares people along the way.
Where's the incentive to spend, you know, 35 grand on a vehicle that you know as soon as you drive it off the forecourt, essentially it's going to be worth half the price?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, that's one of the arguments against EVs at the moment, but can you control the depreciation on these vehicles? How much of it is driven by a misinformation, by scare, by fears? What is the reticence of buyers? You know, it's buyers that will dictate the used car price values in that regard. And if they're not buying, if they're not prepared to make the leap into EVs, if the used car buyer isn't prepared to make that leap, that's going to have a massive impact on used car prices. So there is that factor there at the moment. And that's something that information will overcome in many ways and at least will bring back up again. It can be very frustrating for the industry and for the dealers, but it can also be very frustrating for an EV
buyer. This isn't just an Irish trend, though. This is
a global issue.
A global issue.
And what you have, if you also consider one of the other big factors that are kicking in here, is that you had very expensive lithium batteries at the start. The prices are coming down. So that means the new car price is coming down. Plus, you have a massive influx of Chinese companies who some
BYD
would claim,
and others.
BYD, MG, GM, Great Wall have come in with their Auras as well. But there's a lot of other manufacturers coming in and new brands. NIO is coming into, it's not here yet, but NIO and a few others are coming into the marketplace. There's a plethora of Chinese brands on their way to Europe are already here. And there's already on questions about whether they are selling at profit in Europe. And that's obviously having an impact if they're flooding the European market with lower priced cars that the Europeans can't compete. Having invested billions in their manufacturing based on a particular model and securing a particular volume of the marketplace, if they're not securing that volume and the marketplace isn't as large, that's going to really undermine the European car manufacturers, and that's an opportunity for China, and that could have huge ramifications for the European auto industry.
So in terms of government incentives, I know there are people in the industry who are saying that the government has trimmed the incentives, hasn't it, particularly for hybrids, that they should restore those incentives. It's the only way to get people back buying.
There's a multitude of options for the government to incentivize, and many other European countries have models that we could adopt or certainly study. And it's interesting that Denmark several years ago dramatically reduced the EVs, believing they'd secured, the public had secured the idea that we're going to buy EVs and we're going down that route. When they switched off the tap of grants and subsidies, the market dried up and they had to switch them back on again. So it does show that the market is very sensitive to price. And we have personal experience of that when we moved to the CO2 taxation system as opposed to a cubic capacity size. And there was people really cared about whether there was €100 in the difference between a petrol or a diesel car, when in fact you're probably, it would take you, you know, the difference
exactly.
in price.
There was some irrationality.
There was massively irrationality. So the same thing can apply in terms of grants. Mm-hmm. There are incentives, for example, the use of access to certain areas of the city where non-EVs wouldn't be allowed. Congestion charging, if it ever came to pass, that's an area. Discounts on the tolls. Access to bus routes. There's various incentives that other countries have used that seemed quite tempting to people and that helped them to make that move to electric. I would say one of the priorities and the government's department or organisation called ZEVI, which are supposed to lead the way in terms of dealing and tackling with the drive towards electric vehicles. One of their priorities is getting the infrastructure in place, and it needs to be. Now, they've they seem to prioritize getting more people to get charging at home and support that idea of you charge at home and you just use the public infrastructure to top up on long journeys. But people need to be confident that they can top up, that their network is in place. And also there needs to be a greater clarity in terms of pricing structure for electricity. Because if you pull up at a petrol pump, at any stations, you visit three stations, you can see the price of diesel, you can see the price of petrol on it. But it's still quite opaque as to how much you pay. And if you have a card for that particular, or you're buying it straight, and the nightly rates versus the daily charge, it's still quite a grey area in terms of electric pricing. And we need a little bit of clarity in terms of that as well, I think, would help incentivize people. How much is this going to cost me? How much am I paying for my electricity here in East Georgia? And make that a competitive marketplace as well, along with putting in place the infrastructure so people can charge. If you get that in place, plus a few incentives are around there, I think those would be the major incentives that would help people overcome their anxiety or their reticence to make that leap over. And again, it's about educating people about battery life. Some of that comes down to the industry, and they need to do that. But in terms of the infrastructure and the rest, that's where the government steps in.
So has the Irish Times motoring editor bought into electric?
I spend a lot of time testing loads of cars. But electric, we have a plug-in hybrid in our house.
Good compromise.
So that's the bridge at the moment. And I know they're heavily criticised by some of the environmental groups because they say it's the worst of all worlds because you're carrying an engine with you when you're running on electric, which is quite heavy, and then you're carrying a big empty battery when you're running on petrol. But I think as an initial experience it's the easiest way to make that leap over. And, you know, I live in a neighbourhood where my next door neighbour has gone electric. Has had trouble trading in. So a lot of those first-hand experiences, and I know that, you know, he's spoken to other neighbours in the area, and it's that level, I've seen firsthand, that level of conversation and discussion and first-hand experiences has an impact on others who then step back. All they have to hear is one inconvenient element or you know, the chargers were broken. I couldn't get a trade in into that dealership. That's a scare. And what I said at the very start, for a lot of people, the car is way down the list of priorities in their life. Any inconvenience at all, and they'll just step back and go, I'll wait until this is all fixed. I've got bigger issues on my plate at the moment, and I'll deal with that when I really need to do. So I think you're probably seeing a lot of the mainstream buyers in the used car markets going again with either petrol or hybrids is where the big growth is, until a lot of the upheaval and depreciation elements and all the other things are sorted. And that includes technology as well. So that's where we're at the moment.
Michael McAleer, thank you for joining us.
No problem, thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. When I return, I'll be talking to Ombra Kennedy of the Irish Times about the drop in inflation in March and what it might mean for Irish mortgage rates. Back in a few moments.
How can harnessing the power of AI help drive your business? At EY, we combine leading business expertise with cutting-edge technology and capabilities. Working directly with you to plan your strategy, we will accelerate your AI-enabled transformation. To learn more, visit ey.ai/IE.
Welcome back. This is Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. Irish inflation fell below 2% in March for the first time in 3 years. Ombra Kennedy of the Irish Times joined me on the line to discuss this and the implications for Irish mortgage rates. I began by asking him to explain the factors behind the decline in Irish inflation last month.
Okay, so yeah, we got, I suppose, what you describe as a good news story, not a great news story for consumers because headline prices are still rising, but the harmonized index of consumer prices, which is a standardized measure that Eurostat used to compare inflation across countries and also to compile a headline rate for the Eurozone, in Ireland fell to 1.7% in March. Now, that was the lowest we've had for 3 years, and of course, crucially, under the ECB's 2% target rate. So the prices have fallen. Not to say things are getting cheaper, as I just said. Gas and electricity prices have come down internationally, and that's been the main driver of this softening of headline inflation. But just to give you some perspective on that, they're still about 80% above where they might have been, or what you might have considered normal prior to the pandemic. Food costs, similarly, are 20 to 25% above where they were 2.5 years ago. So consumers still feeling the pinch. And then the government's reduced excise rate on fuel, that's come off as well. So they're going back up. So there's a lot of things that are keeping pressure on households still going on.
Yeah, now this HICP is a measure used by the European Union, but it differs from the Consumer Price Index in Ireland, doesn't it? Just explain that to us, Owen.
Yeah. So as I said, this is a measure that the Eurostat EU statistical agency use so they can essentially compile a headline inflation rate for the Eurozone. And it's typically lower in the current phase than the headline consumer price index that we use as our barometer for inflation. And the main reason for that is that the CPI, the consumer price index, includes mortgage interest payments. And of course, they've gone up on the back of 10 consecutive interest rate rises by the ECB. So there's a disparity between the two rates. So the CPI in February, the last one we've got, was still above 3%. And the harmonized index of consumer prices, the HICP for March, which we just got this week, has fallen below 2%.
Okay, so we're below the 2% ECB inflation target rate. Now, figures came out today for EU-wide HICP, consumer price inflation. Essentially, what did that show?
Yeah, so that showed that inflation across the single currency block softened to 2.4%. Now, analysts had expected it to soften to 2.5%, so it's falling marginally quicker than what economists and perhaps ECB policymakers were expecting, which is, again, good news for consumers, and almost makes a June interest rate cut by the ECB, which they've kind of been signaling anyway, a certainty at this stage. So what they'll do in terms of size of the interest rate cut in June and how many they might implement this year is still, open to speculation.
Yeah, now the Greek central banker, who's a member of the ECB Governing Council, was out at the weekend. He was interviewed in Greek media at the weekend, and he was suggesting that there could be four cuts in the interest rate this year. But he also seemed to be suggesting that the cuts will be of the order of 25 basis points. So put them all together and you're talking about a 1 percentage point reduction in rates this year. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, well, I suppose the four rate scenario was the first time we've heard of that, and that was a kind of bullish prediction, I suppose. But then, as you say, if they're going at small and cautious steps of a quarter point each time, that's still a kind of cautious outlook. And it's in keeping with what the ECB's chief economist, Philip Lane, has warned, that inflation in the services sector is still high and it's still being driven by wage growth. So there's a certain amount of caution within the ECB itself in terms of just lifting the kind of anvil of interest rates that have been heaped on the block to try and quash inflation. So it's optimistic. It's cautiously optimistic. Again, as you say, you know, four rate cuts sounds good, but cumulatively it could just amount to 1% by next Christmas, which is, you know, modest.
Yeah. Now, what's the outlook for inflation in Ireland? Because on the same day that the CSO was releasing that inflation figure, we had Kantar with its latest data on the Irish grocery market, and it showed that the rate of inflation softened, but it was still running at 3.7% in the 12 weeks to the middle of last month. And as you mentioned earlier, some of the excise duty cuts that were introduced by the government as part of a cost of living package to help people make ends meet, some of those were unwound from Monday, and the rest of it's to be unwound in August. So that's going to increase the price of petrol and diesel, you would have to imagine.
Yeah, I mean, what we said at the outset, I mean, we're kind of heralding these softening moves on the inflation as good news for consumers, but we have to remind ourselves that prices in general are still rising. And Ireland is, as we know, one of the most expensive places in Europe to find yourself. And to the point you've just made, some of the individual items are going up at a significant rate. So the pressure on households and the cost of living is still rising here. And that is going to dominate the news. It's going to dominate the economic news coming into the budget and coming into perhaps an election later this year or next year. Yeah, it's still a very difficult environment for consumers. Incidentally, the fact that headline inflation here and core inflation here are running below the euro area average suggests that fears, you know, that we've had fears and warnings from the central bank and others in recent months that if inflation started barreling up here on the basis of domestic pressures and domestic items, that we could have more overheating pressures. Now, the fact that headline inflation here is running below the EU average, that suggests that the kind of overheating fears, if you like, might be just a little bit overbaked at the moment. And that may give the government more room for maneuver, more financial headroom, if you like, in the upcoming budget, which may have implications politically.
What about wages, Owen? What pace have they been rising at? And we see there's a pilots dispute at Aer Lingus, where Aer Lingus says the pilots are looking for 27%. The pilots dispute that, but Aer Lingus says it's offering essentially just over 12%. That's over a three-year period. Those kind of wage increases can't be sustainable if inflation is below 2%.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very difficult one. It's a very difficult one to get a handle on wages here. We constantly get a figure of around 3 and 4% for the economy as a whole. But obviously, sectors, public, private, individual sectors in the private sector as well, all have different wage increases. So it's very difficult to get a handle on actually what's happening. But yeah, as you say, the central bank and others like to talk about real wage catch-up. So workers coming to their employers saying, look, we've suffered quite significantly over the last 2 or 3 years and we want now a pickup in wages. And obviously, they can be indulged to a certain point before things start overheating and getting uncompetitive. And where that line is drawn is just very difficult to tell. 4% seems to be a sustainable rate in the central bank's eyes. And yet some of the deals, and the public sector deal included, are bigger than that. So we'll just have to see where we go from here.
Yeah, and finally, Owen, look into your crystal ball. In terms of the 1 percentage point decrease in rates that's been suggested, if it happens by the end of the year, do you think the Irish banks will pass it on to their mortgage customers? We know that the tracker mortgage customers will benefit because they're pegged to the ECB rate. So if it goes up, their mortgage goes up. If it goes down, their mortgage goes down. But what about those on fixed rates and variables? Do you think it will change?
Yeah, well, that's been a big narrative here, hasn't it? The pass through here has been slow. I mean, prior to this whole period, we were up in arms about why the variable rates and various rates attached to mortgages were conspicuously higher in Ireland than the euro area average. Then when these increases came, they didn't materialise here as quickly as they have done in other countries. So in many ways, some of the banks shielded us from the hikes at an ECB level. But of course, the critics would say, well, their rates were already higher than elsewhere, so they weren't doing much shielding over a longer period. So it seems the banks here are kind of working to a certain extent outside of the European counterparts. So yeah, you'd probably caution that consumers can expect a slow pass-through at this stage from what we've seen in the last 2 years.
Umber Kennedy, thank you for joining us. Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Michael McAleer and Umber Kennedy for joining me on the show. John Casey produced this episode with JJ Vernon on sound. Thanks also to our sponsor EY for its continued support. Remember, as a subscriber to the Irish Times, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed each day on X, LinkedIn and Facebook. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.
The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.